I'm on vacation at a sea turtle nesting beach in Florida, but so far the Wi-Fi seems relatively stable, so just please let me know if any issues come up. For folks that don't know me, I'm Dr. Vince Sub. I work for the Northeast Fisheries Science Center's Ecosystem Dynamics and Assessments Branch, but I sit at the NOAA Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab in Princeton, New Jersey, where I lead climate research for the center. So today I'd like to give folks an overview of our Northeast Regional Action Plan Version 2 with some primers on what we've done over the last 5 years. Next slide, please. So the outline of today's talk, I reduced it a little bit relative to what I gave to the SSC, given our time constraints. But I want to go over some observed change that we've been looking at in the U.S. Northeast Shelf, some stuff that we've presented in our State of the Ecosystem reports. Then I want to give a brief overview of our accomplishments under the NERAP 1.0 from 2016 to around 2021. And then I want to kind of go over those accomplishments in the context of what we think, where we think we're lacking, where our needs are, and where we need to focus our priority actions for our current draft of our NERAP 2.0, which will cover fiscal years 22 through 24. Next slide, please. So I just want to acknowledge all of the co-authors and contributors to the NERAP 2.0. These folks here are with the Science Center, the Regional Office, and also the Chesapeake Bay Office. Next slide, please. So just to give you kind of an overview of the change that we've observed in our region relative to other regions across the country, our region, the U.S. Northeast Shelf, has warmed faster than any other region across the country over the last decade. And so what you're seeing here is sea surface temperature on the left, measured by satellites, and ocean bottom temperature on the right, which is is based on what we call an ocean model reanalysis product, which combines observations and model interpolation to fill in the gaps for ocean bottom temperature. But what you can see is not only has the surface temperature warmed faster over the last decade, the bottom temperature has also warmed extremely fast relative to other regions. In fact, one could argue, based on the reanalysis product, that bottom temperature really stands out relative to surface temperature. Next slide, please. So in the context of temperature, we also look at other indicators. We report on these annually in our State Ecosystem Report. So one of the key indicators, two of the key indicators that we do look at is the Gulf Stream Index, shown at the top. And we also show slope water changes that we measure in the Northeast Channel of the Gulf of Maine. So one consistent trend that we've seen over the last 10 years is this northern shift in the position of the Gulf Stream's northern wall, which is shown in the top. At the same time, we've also seen change in the proportion of slope waters that enter the Gulf of Maine via the Northeast Channel at depth, which you see in the bottom panel. The red line are warmer slope waters associated with the Gulf Stream, and the blue line are colder, fresher waters associated with the Labrador Current. And in particular, over the last 10 years, we've seen a larger proportion of Gulf Stream-associated water entering the Gulf of Maine, as we've also seen a change in the Gulf Stream position. And we're attributing the enhanced warming over the last 10 years to this change in regional circulation, which we're associating with climate change and larger scale circulation change across the Atlantic Basin. Next slide, please. We're also observing changes in ocean pH. So as some of you might be aware, as the atmosphere is taking in more anthropogenic carbon dioxide, the oceans are absorbing that carbon dioxide and becoming more acidic. And so the measurements that we've taken over the last couple of decades have mostly derived from the surface. So this is what the slide shows here. And the 0.1 decrease in surface pH is about consistent what we're seeing globally relative to what is being released into the atmosphere in terms of carbon dioxide. Next slide, please. So I apologize here. I guess the slide didn't come through. But what this is supposed to show is the Northeast Fisheries Science Center bottom trawl survey. This is for the fall. And if you take the center of biomass over the last few decades, it essentially is showing a northern shift. So this may be the PDF version that didn't come through, so I do apologize. We're also showing that fish caught in our fall bottom trawl survey have been also caught in deeper water. So we're seeing a general northern shift in the center of biomass from our fall survey. At least it's most predominant in the fall compared to the spring. And we're also seeing that species are being caught in deeper water. Next slide, please. So when the National Climate Science Strategy was released in 2015, this is not legislation, this is a guidance document. The national strategy required every single region to develop their own regional action plan. So in our region, we have the Northeast Regional Action Plan, of which version 2.0 is current in the public review phase. Next slide, please. I'm not sure what that slide is. So we have a Northeast Regional Action Plan. This was published in 2016, and we've been reporting to Fisheries Headquarters every year on our accomplishments. And then we were, each region was then tasked with creating a version 2.0 over a three-year period. So for fiscal years 22 for 24, and then we'll reevaluate again and create another plan to address our needs and actions as we see things changing over the course of our research year to year, and how we assess our metrics in terms of if we're actually approaching consider some of these, how we're identifying actions, if we need to identify new actions, and where we're lacking. Next slide, please. Okay, so I'm not really sure what's going on with the talk. This is not the talk that I uploaded, but unfortunately there's some problems with this presentation. Next slide, please. Okay, this is not my talk. I don't know what this is. This looks, keep going down. Okay, this is much better. These are my slides. So you can, I guess you can advance to where I left off. Just to it right there is probably good. So if there's a way to maximize that so that folks can see the full slide, that'd be great. Thank you. So I apologize, folks. I don't know what happened here, but something got lost in translation when the talks were uploaded. So the National Climate Science Strategy identified seven main objectives. These objectives are all interdependent. Again, this was published in 2015, so about 7 years ago. The bottom objectives you see there, building and maintaining adequate science infrastructure, tracking change, providing early warnings, understanding mechanisms of change, projecting future conditions. A lot of this is based on our core research activities. And none of it can take place without the very bottom objective, which is building and maintaining adequate science infrastructure. So things like our surveys, collaborating with other NOAA line offices, so on and so forth. The top three objectives are really where we are focused on informing the management process. So climate-informed reference points, robust management strategies, and adaptive management processes. And these can look very different from region to region. Next slide, please. Please, you can keep advancing. I already covered this one. Okay. So in terms of, you know, one of the key things where we are, we have concerns is our infrastructure in terms of our observation. So over the course of the last 4 to 5 decades, we've been observing a gradual decline in our, not only our days at sea, but our number of measurements. So what this slide is showing you are our bottom temperature measurements from the 1960s to near present. You can see 2020 was our record low year for measurements, obviously due to COVID. But this is concerning for us, considering we're in a period of increasing trends in physical conditions and also increasing variability. So our number of measurements have been declining over the past 3 to 4 decades. Next slide, please. We were among one of the first regions to identify complete a climate vulnerability assessment. This was conducted for over 80 species of invertebrates and vertebrates across the U.S. Northeast. And essentially, it was a collaboration of experts from multiple fields and disciplines to identify which species and stocks were vulnerable to future climate change. And no surprises were found here in a sense, based on what we've observed in terms of changes in abundance and distribution in the contemporary period, folks found that these species would be most species were either highly vulnerable or very highly vulnerable to future climate change in terms of both distribution changes and abundance. And this was mostly derived from temperature changes. Next slide, please. We were also the first region to conduct a climate vulnerability analysis of habitat. And so this was just published last year by FAR et al. I believe it's the same journal, PLOS ONE, that the Herr et al. Paper was published in. And the take-home message from this study was that most habitats were either were found to be either neutrally vulnerable to climate change or negatively, with a very small subset that were actually positively impacted by future climate change. And those were almost all exclusively related to Phragmites, so these invasive marsh wetland species that do very well under warmer and more acidic conditions in the future. Next slide, please. We've also made progress in terms of our social sciences and our social vulnerability analysis. So this was a paper published by Lisa Colbert et al. In 2016, looking at various fishing ports across the U.S. Northeast. And what they found here essentially was that the ports that had a higher diversity in catch were less vulnerable to future climate change. Those ports that had a lower diversity in catch were more vulnerable to future climate change. Next slide, please. We've also made progress in our scenario planning efforts. So as most of you are aware, the East Coast scenario planning exercise is going on right now. We've completed scenario planning for endangered North Atlantic right whales and also Atlantic salmon. Those reports are available, and we're currently working on a publication for that for a peer-reviewed journal. But the key behind these scenario planning exercises are really looking at long-term potential scenarios. In these cases, we look at four different scenarios for salmon and right whales, and different climate scenarios. And essentially, what the goals are to help manage risk and prioritize management actions over the long term. One major difference between these previous exercises for salmon and right whales compared to the East Coast climate change scenario planning is the time frame. The salmon and the right whale exercises were conducted over a long century scale time scales, whereas the East Coast climate change scenario is over a multi-decadal 15 to 20 year time scale. Next slide, please. We've also made a lot of progress in our laboratory studies. It is almost impossible for us to create models of the impacts of climate change on either single species or stocks or populations or multi-species without these key laboratory studies on phytoplankton and shellfish and finfish as well, looking at changes in ocean temperature in the lab, changes, synergistic changes of ocean acidification and temperature, and how that impacts various life history parameters such as recruitment, survival, feeding rates, so on and so forth. Next slide, please. We've also made, over the last 5 years, a lot of progress on identifying or incorporating climate information to various assessment variables. Now, this is not to say these are incorporated into operational assessments, but they have been analyzed in terms of things like spawning stock biomass, recruitment, so on and so forth. And over the past few years, we've started to rely on the Woodtull assessment model, which was designed by Stock and Miller in 2021. And this model allows for time-varying processes with links to environmental covariates. And I will show a slide of an example of that for Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Yellowtail Flounder. Next slide, please. We've also relied a lot on our high-resolution global climate models. This region is highly complex oceanographically. And so a lot of the work that I've been leading, particularly given my situation sitting at NOAA GFDL, is to use these high-resolution climate models to conduct our long-term projections for many of the species, commercial and rec stocks, and protected species in the U.S. Northeast. So the left figure showed, this should be an animation if it was in PowerPoint, so it's, I apologize that it's not running as a film. But the left shows you what a high-resolution model looks like for sea surface temperature on the left, and the right is a standard coarse resolution model, about 100 kilometers horizontal resolution, on the right side, but basically what you can see is that the Gulf Stream overshoots Cape Hatteras. It doesn't break off the east coast of the U.S. like it should. These high resolutions are critical when we're talking about long-term and near-term climate change in terms of forecasts for the U.S. Northeast, because it is such a complex region oceanographically. These coarse models simply can't resolve those fine-scale features. Next slide, please. So if we look at the projections of warming from these high-res models, they are very different compared to the standard IPCC coarse models that are assessed every 6 to 7 years. Essentially, what we find is that with the high-res models, we don't get uniform warming across the U.S. eastern seaboard. You can see this enhanced warming in the Gulf of Maine, the Scotian Shelf, and that is exactly, in that bottom right panel, that is exactly what we're observing today. And I showed you in that previous slide at the beginning of my talk. We're observing this enhanced warming in the U.S. Northeast, and this NOAA model is one of the few that resolve that enhanced warming that we're observing today. So we've been using this model consistently over the last 5 years for long-term projections. Next slide, please. So what have we been doing with these models? We've been mostly focused on the long-term. So this is an example from a paper in 2019. This is showing projections for winter flounder. The left panel is showing the winter flounder model using various variables from the high-res model, salinity, temperature, sea surface height. The right panel is the temperature-only model. And what you can see is that when you project changes in winter flounder distribution using only temperature, it looks very different than the right side using multiple variables. In particular, bottom salinity was the strongest predictor variable of winter flounder habitat, and that's why there's differences between the two models. So you can have very different projected outcomes for certain species depending on if you use just temperature alone versus multiple variables. And we've seen similar situations for species like lobster, scallop, cobia. We've looked at Calanus finmarchica, zooplankton, loggerhead turtles, so on and so forth. So we're using this high-res model for multiple species, and the take-home message is we should be looking at variables beyond temperature in these future projections. Next slide, please. And we're starting to make headway on new high-resolution regional models for the entire U.S. eastern seaboard, including the Gulf of Mexico. This also should be an animation, but essentially the take-home message here is that we're now trying to incorporate biogeochemical variables and coupling them to these physics-only models. This is showing surface chlorophyll running daily, and, well, it would be running daily if it was in animation mode, but we're trying to nest these regional high-res models for various regions across the U.S., and this is part of the Climate Ecosystem Fisheries Initiative, which unfortunately wasn't funded for this current fiscal year. We're hoping that for fiscal year 23 it does get funded, so that we can make further progress on NOAA's modeling capabilities and their application to NOAA fisheries research and management. Next slide, please. So one metric that we've used over the last few years in terms of our progress on how we're addressing our NERAP actions is publications. It's at least one consistent way. It may not be the best metric, but that's what we've used over the last few years. And where we find that we've been lacking is on the objectives 1 through 3, the informing management side. We've made a lot of progress on understanding mechanisms, projecting long-term change, looking at observed changes, tracking change. But in terms of getting these analyses into operational tactical fisheries management decisions is where we've been lacking. And that's where our new NERAP version tends to focus on. Next slide, please. This is a slide I like to show in a lot of my talks. This is from Tomasi et al. 2017. It gives you a sense of the spatial and temporal scales that both the climate weather system operates on versus the fisheries and protected resource management system. And so really where we've been focused in terms of our research of the last 5 years has been the decadal and century scale, so to your right there, which is obviously a larger spatial scale as well. Large-scale basin change, mean state, mean changes in the mean climate. Where we need to focus on is these near-term seasonal annual changes in the system that can inform management. The problem is that in the U.S. Northeast, as I mentioned before, it's such an oceanographically complex region, the skill of our near-term forecast is among the worst globally. There was just a paper published in Nature this year on forecasting marine heat waves, and our system is so complex that the models don't even resolve a large portion of the Gulf of Maine. So that's where that previous slide where I showed you those high-res pilot studies. We're trying to make progress on that and improve our forecasting skill that can hopefully inform management. Next slide, please. So in terms of our priorities, I'll be wrapping up here shortly. So we've now narrowed our priorities down to 10 major actions for the NERAP 2.0. The first three priorities are linked to Objective 7 of the National Strategy, which is maintaining infrastructure. So things like maintaining our current ecosystem surveys, our bottom trawl surveys, our species-specific surveys like northern shrimp, sea scallop surveys, and also starting new surveys and collaborating with our coastal surveys and state surveys as well. Also, it's important for us for coordinating with other NOAA programs. I think I'm an example of that, where I'm a NOAA fisheries scientist embedded in a NOAA climate lab, improving these collaborations and reaching out to other low and nine offices and partners and stakeholders and industry leaders as well. And also maintaining our industry-based surveys as well. So our cooperative research program is absolutely critical to fill in those gaps that our fall and spring surveys are missing. Next slide, please. So objectives four through six, priority actions four through six, these are related to the national objectives four through six as well. And these are essentially not only tracking change in terms of our observations, but also continue the production of our state ecosystem reports. So we report out to the councils every year, and the SOEs have been a great way for us to communicate with councils in terms of new products, new data products, new forecasting products, and also getting feedback on what's needed in these reports. As I mentioned before, our laboratory studies have been critical, and these need to continue as well. Next slide, please. And then these last four actions, these are related to informing management. So we put a lot of focus into these four actions. And these they're not all exclusive to things like long-term change, scenario planning, spatial management, things like that, but also getting more social sciences, human dimension science into our climate science. So that's priority action nine. The last action, which I think is one of the most important ones, is the development of stock assessment models that include environmental terms. And one way we think, one on-ramp we think to management may be through the research track assessment process. And that is something that we focus on a little bit more in the second version of our action plan. Next slide, please. So this is a table of the current and future research track assessments for various stocks. And this table also shows the two columns on the right showing identified environmental variables to life history parameters, life history variables. And so these are different publications historically that have shown linkages between the ocean environment and various life history variables that could possibly be further explored into incorporating climate information into the assessment process. Next slide, please. This is my last slide. And so this is an example that we just published this year that did just that. Here we looked at the sub-New England Mid-Atlantic population of yellowtail flounder. We already knew from Tim Miller's previous work and others that there was a relationship between the cold pool and yellowtail recruitment, but we wanted a higher resolution metric of the cold pool, so we relied on ocean models. We took high-res ocean models, we bias-corrected them, and we also combined them with observations to come up with new metrics of the cold pool, and we wanted to take these new metrics that were based on ocean models, incorporate them into the population model using WAM, so we worked closely with Tim Miller and Brian Stonko on this project, and we did see a change in the retrospective patterns, a reduction in those retrospective patterns in terms of spawning stock biomass and recruitment when we incorporated these new indices of the cold pool. So this may be a way where we can help inform these upcoming research track assessments and hopefully get this information into the management process. And I'll stop right there. And I apologize again, folks, for the slide issues. I don't know what happened there.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Saba. That was a lot of information and really good work. So let's see what the council has for questions. Any questions for Dr. Saba? Mr. Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Saba, for the presentation. I want to ask you to go back to the slides because we had issues with the slides, but there was one on the climate science strategy objectives, and one of those was around tracking change and providing early warnings. And I believe in the slide following that, you had expressed some concerns about declines over time in your observations, and I was wondering if you could speak to a minute about the source of the observations and the reasons for some of the declines in those observations over time?
Yeah, that's a great point. And, I think as far as I know, and I'm probably not the best person to comment on this, one of the, funding issues are probably one of the main sources of decline. Obviously, the 2020 year due to COVID was the main reason there. But That is a big concern for us because we're in a period of increasing trends and variability, yet we're declining in our observations. And so, one way around this is, we have no control of, at least I don't have any control of getting more funding for surveys, is to rely on ocean models that are assimilating observations. And so that's why a few of my slides were focused on these high-resolution ocean models that are simulating observations to fill in those gaps where we're missing critical information, particularly in the winter and summer seasons when we have less surveys going. Obviously, you know, most of our surveys are in the spring and fall. So that is a big concern for us. And so in the interim, that's why we feel these ocean models are important.
Yeah, thanks for that. If I could follow up quickly, I agree the models could be one source of that information, but the one I was actually interested in was under your action three, which was building better partnerships with industry to do some of that observation work. I know we have the EMOLT program. I know that there are temperature sensors available that could put on the doors of fishing gear and gill nets, and I think there's an opportunity to work in partnership with industry moving forward to fill some of those data gaps. They're on the water a lot more than the surveys are, and they see a lot more than the surveys do. And I just hope that as you move this action plan forward, special attention is paid to the action item number three. If you have anything else to add on how you plan on doing that, I would appreciate it. But I think there's an opportunity there that should not be missed. Thanks.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've talked to folks at our Climate and Oceans branch about this as well. There is, in terms of incorporating those fisheries-dependent observations into our temperature database, there's different sensors that are used on some of those within some of those programs. But I do know the EMOLT data. There's currently talks with NOAA NCEI with incorporating the EMOLT data into our Northwest Atlantic climatologies. And I'm not sure if you can go back to that slide, the paper that I showed, the 2019 paper on winter, the one showing the example of winter flounder, that was one of the first papers where we used fisheries-dependent data to build habitat models for these species 12 months throughout the year. Historically, we've only been doing fall and spring habitat models because we've been relying exclusively on our trawl surveys, which are fall and spring. We found that when we use that observer data, even though it is tricky combining fisheries-dependent and fisheries-independent information, that we did see a different habitat picture because, as most of you know, the temperature swings in this region are among some of the highest in the world. And so species are moving north, south, east, west constantly as the seasons are changing. And so that was, I think, is a good example of what we can accomplish when we're using the observer data from the cooperative program. So, yeah, that's a great point.
Okay, next I have Dr. Sissonwire and then Mr. Pirtnak.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Lots of good information here and exciting science. But candidly, I'm concerned about whether the emphasis is on the exciting science or the actual translation of the results into operational management processes. Just as an example, that you seem to be putting a lot of emphasis on better refinement of climate models so you get more detailed information about the climate background that might be driving some of the variability in the stocks. And, you know, this seems to be taking a long time, and I'm wondering how necessary that is. I'm particularly struck because one of the examples that was shown was of yellowtail flounder, southern New England specifically, and its dependence on temperature. You cited Miller's paper in, I think it was 2016, and are talking about a benchmark, I believe, that would address this further in approximately 2024, maybe it was, something like that. Maybe it was 23. I have to be struck by a paper I'm looking at right now in front of me that I published in 1974, 50 years ago, that explained from 86% to 93% of the variability in recruitment of southern New England yellowtail flounder. And it was followed by stock assessment models that did that as well. So, I mean, that my general point is this has taken a long time, and that the detailed climate information. The detailed climate research that says things are changing is critically important for all sorts of reasons, but detailed climate models that produce more refined measures may not be as necessary, particularly for some of the stocks that we know have responded for decades to variations in the environment. The other issue I have is that while the emphasis is clearly shifting, as you've said, in this revision of the plan to better informing management, and that's great, I'm wondering what process is in place to not only better inform management, but to design management so it can actually use that information. And I raise that in the context of experience I've had in the last 3 years as part of a group, national group, that's dealing with technical guidance for national standard one, which deals with overfishing and so forth. And of course, a key element of that is how you define reference points, fishing mortality and biological. And the implications of all this climate research is that those are dynamic. But yet in that process, there's, in my view, hasn't been much progress made in terms of giving technical guidance as to how managers will actually use dynamic reference points. So I have those two concerns. While I'm entirely supportive of all the science that's going on, and I think it's excellent science, how are we going to actually make this happen in terms of impacting management? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your comments and questions. So for your first comment question regarding the refinement of the models and using why that's even needed. So one major issue, and this I believe is global, is that there are very few operational assessments that use even observed environmental information. So that is obviously a huge problem. So not just speaking for our country, but across the globe. Additionally, on top of that, like I mentioned earlier in my talk, we've been mostly focused on these decadal century scale changes because that's easier. There's much less uncertainty in terms of we're predicting or projecting a change in the mean state of the climate. Okay, so the U.S. Northeast Shelf gets, we project to get warm by X number of degrees, 3-4 degrees centigrade. That's not helpful for operational year-to-year management decisions like you just mentioned. So one of the reasons why we are trying to put focus on these refined models, these higher resolution models, is because the skill of our forecasts for our region are among the worst globally. And the reason is because these forecasting models are too coarse. They don't resolve the fine scale circulation features of the U.S. Northeast Shelf, which is relatively small relative to the global ocean. And so if, for example, a particular assessment requires a prediction, like, for example, the Yellowtail flounder example, a year forecast out of the cold pool in terms of its magnitude, its duration, its persistence, whatever the metric that's important, we would need a high-resolution model to run that forecast. And even going historically, because most of our information comes from the fall and spring, and we're lacking daily cold pool data, we need these high-resolution models to give us a historical sense of changes in the cold pool. And the example that I showed earlier shows that when you do that, you can, in fact, reduce the retrospective patterns and spawning stock biomass and recruitment. Even though the magnitude of that change wasn't substantial, it was still statistically significant. So our region is unique in a sense, compared to the California current, the Bering Sea, is that the resolution of these models really does matter. And we have a hard time getting skillful predictions of, just think something simple like ocean surface temperature change 3 months out from now. And then to your second point, I think you had a few points there. Can you clarify a bit more on exactly what you want me to answer? Because I was mostly focused on point one. There was a lot to discuss there.
Yeah, thank you for your response. And the second question probably is more broadly directed at the agency than is you as a scientist sitting at GFDL. And that is that the implication of all of this is that biological reference points, which are sort of a foundation of all of the specification setting processes that, you know, being consistent with not overfishing or the design of rebuilding plans are dynamic as a result of the impacts of environmental variability and many other factors. And they're not only dynamic, but they're likely changing with trend, you know, that is in a non-stationary way as a result of the non-stationarity of climate with a long-term trend. That requires rethinking a lot of the operational ways that management is done. And one of the ways one would rethink that is within the context of technical guidance within national standards. But yet, at this point, there's been little progress made on that based on my firsthand experience of observing that process as one of the people involved in it. So I think there, if this action plan is really to be successful, there has to really be a concerted effort to really think through the processes and the implications, some of which may have legal implications, of dynamic reference points and how they will be used. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's where I think we've been struggling and trying to figure out where, you know, how we can impact the management process sooner rather than later. For example, looking at this table here in terms of the research track assessments, and I spoke to John here multiple times about this in terms of these on-ramps, where's the low-hanging fruit? Maybe this isn't the best way, but in terms of when new information does arise, you know, in terms of, you know, dynamic reference points, new research that identifies new environmental variables that can actually reduce retrospective patterns and improve management. I don't know what the best way is, and I don't know if that's beyond the scope of this action plan and more of a NOAA-wide action. But, this is why we have our action plan out for public comment, and we're hoping to get feedback from not just the SSC, but from council members on ideas on how we can do just that. And that's why, we're doing this presentation and we're still in the draft phase of our action plan. So I appreciate your comment, and I'm looking forward to, using your comments for the revision. Thank you.
Thank you. I didn't mean to dump all of that on you, but thank you very much.
That's okay. Not a problem. No, I understand.
Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for your presentation. There is a slide with two different tables on it, vulnerability to changes in species distribution and abundance. My question is, does this include an impact on species that may migrate into an area, which we'll use an example of black sea bass, for example, moving farther north or east into cooler waters, and then subsequently, what is that impact of that species on the ecosystem or predator-prey relationships for resident fish within that area? So does that include that kind of assessment within that vulnerability table?
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, that point came up at the SSC talk as well. So the vulnerability assessment did not account for multi-species interactions, if that is what you're asking. So, for example, species like black sea bass, a species on the move to the north right now, in terms of their impact on, say, for example, you know, juvenile lobster, that wasn't taken into account in the lobster vulnerability. It was multi-species interactions were not accounted for, as far as I understand that. Now, that is being done as we speak, but it wasn't done in that particular vulnerability assessment.
Thank you. That's good to hear. One last thing with assessing in the state of the ecosystem report for the Northeast, there's economic indicators for the commercial fishers and the impact of such. Does it also include wreck and for hire as an assessment?
Are you referring to our annual SOE, the state ecosystem report?
Correct.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
I believe so. I think so. It's a long report. I need to go. I'm sorry, I have a slide on that. I apologize, but I believe, or at least I know historically we have had wreck indices like that. Obviously commercials in there, but I need to go back and check.
No, thank you. It's long. I hope you can find
it. Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm good.
So you're going to have to find it yourself, Mike. I think that's what he's telling. Mr. Tracy.
I am on vacation. Sorry.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And thanks, Doctor, for this really a great presentation and so much to it. But I was struck on your slide 4, the sea surface temperature and the ocean bottom temperature. Obviously, what jumps out is our region is really one of the only ones where there's a correlation between the two. And so I guess my short question is on this is that solely due to the Gulf Stream? And I'm sure you said this, but I'm just trying to pull it down into my own understanding.
Yeah. So we first published a paper on this. I was the lead author in 2016, where we were just looking at the projections, the long-term projections of bottom temperature change in the U.S. Northeast. At that time, you know, the data was starting to point to, okay, this seems to be happening in our observations. Now that we're, you know, 6 years later, 2022, it turns out that is the case. We are seeing this regional ocean circulation change in which seems to be exclusive to the U.S. Northeast and the Scotian Shelf. There's been other studies that have also occurred over the last few years to try to address what's causing that. And the current theory is that it's a combination of long-term climate change, so the oceans are taking in that excess heat, but also this regional circulation change, which is associated with that northern shift in the Gulf Stream that you just mentioned. Some of my colleagues at URI identified that there is essentially this blocking occurring at the southern end of the tail end of the Grand Banks, where when the Gulf Stream pushes north, it's essentially blocking that colder, fresher Labrador current that wraps around the tail end of the Grand Banks, essentially causing this heat trapping. There's also been some of my colleagues at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute have also identified some atmospheric drivers in terms of the position of the jet stream, depending on what things are doing in the atmosphere and in the stratosphere in the Arctic, and how that impacts the jet stream. So, I guess in a nutshell, to keep it simple, it's likely a synergy of the weakening overturning circulation in the Atlantic, which we think is causing this gradual northern shift in the Gulf Stream, combined with global warming, combined with atmospheric shifts. But you're right, this is one of the few regions where the surface and bottom are correlated. In fact, in the wintertime, and this is something new we're working on, we're finding that the surface temperature in the winter in the U.S. Northeast hasn't really changed all that much. But if you look at the bottom temperature in the winter, we do see significant changes, warming in bottom temperature. So it is pretty striking.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, and forgive me for this follow-up, Doctor, but does this have anything to do with a concentration of sampling in this area? In other words, obviously we're dealing with a huge geographic range here just on the North American graphs you gave us.
Yeah.
I don't mean to imply anything.
Yeah.
Is there anything there to talk about?
Okay, so to relate that to the surface is universal. That's a satellite-based, on the left you're seeing a satellite-based measurement. So the sampling in the U.S. Northeast from a quarter-degree satellite measurement, it's ubiquitous no matter where in the world you're at. Now, in terms of the bottom temperature, you are right that a lot of bottom temperature measurements take place here, but they're mostly restricted to the fall and spring. And so the model, it's a reanalysis product that fills in those gaps based on historical observations and whatever ocean dynamics this particular model uses. But if you look at our observations from our ECOMON survey, which takes place throughout the year, that is an in-situ observation which directly correlates to the Gulf Stream water entering that northeast channel in the Gulf of Maine. And that shows a similar change in what you're seeing on that right panel, where more of that warmer slope water with the Gulf Stream is in fact the predominant source water of the Gulf of Maine slope water system in the Northeast Channel. So that gives us some confidence that this is actually happening.
Okay. All right, I appreciate that answer. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, thank you very much. So before we spin off our own little Gulf Stream eddy, what I'd like to do is go to Dr. Kerr and get some comments from the SSC from her. So, Dr. Kerr.
Thank you, Chair. Just wait for them to bring up the slides. Great. So thank you. I'm here to report out on the SSC review of NOAA's Northeast Regional Climate Action Plan, and the SSE at our June meeting received an overview presentation by Dr. Vince Saba, similar to the one we saw today. And the SSE really, I would just note, appreciated hearing about all the progress that has occurred on this topic based on the prior iteration of the plan, and appreciated the opportunity to ask questions and comment on this new version of the action plan. And we were given the following terms of reference that you can see on the screen there that focused on making suggestions for potential improvement of the plan. The SSE appreciated the work that's gone on by the individuals that contributed to the development of the plan and offered, I'll go through some of the suggestions and comments that were offered up by the SSE during our discussion in June. So where we spent some time was around this suggestion that there be increased attention that should be paid to ensuring climate and fisheries research that's being done in the region is being effectively integrated into the assessment and management process. The SSE also related to this suggested consideration of all other relevant metrics of impact besides publications. And in particular, it was suggested that performance metrics of success of the plan be linked to the top three objectives of the National Climate Science Strategy, which are adaptive management processes, robust management strategies, and climate-informed reference points. So basically tracking how the science moves through the system to achieving impact on those three topics. The SSE also highlighted the general need to shift focus from research occurring at large geographic and longer timescales to geographic and timescales relevant to management and industry decision making. And Vince highlighted this as well as in his presentation. The SSC also suggested that there should be an increased communication on this work, the work being undertaken under the plan with stakeholders, and particularly highlighted a need for additional communication with fishery managers to ensure this movement of the research into the assessment and management realm. The SSC also suggested the plan strengthen documentation of interactions with state agencies, and just noted that this is going to be increasingly relevant and important type of collaboration and interaction as there's shifting stock distributions across state boundaries and in our federal management areas, and more efforts to integrate state surveys to inform stock assessment. There was some concern expressed by the SSE in our discussions about climate impacts that are occurring on specific habitat types that are important to certain life stages of fish. And there was a suggestion to ensure that there's coordination occurring to ensure this information is being provided into the assessment and management process. The SSE supported the use of wind farm platforms or wind company monitoring surveys to ensure continued collection of data in wind energy areas. There was a discussion point about the potential loss of information as these areas increase in size. And then finally, there was a suggested inclusion of more focus in the plan on climate adaptation strategies in the region, and a suggestion to include documentation of what adaptive strategies are already being employed in our fisheries in this region, and strategies that also might be useful in the future to support our resilient fisheries given projected climate impacts in the future. So that's the summary of our SSE discussion at our June meeting, and I'm happy to take any questions on our comments on the report, and just want to acknowledge that the SSE really appreciated Dr. Saba's time and the general content of the report. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. Let's see if there's any questions for you. Anybody from the council have questions of Dr. Kerr and the SSC's report? Mr. Pappalardo.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Both this report and the previous report seem to indicate what I think we've all been aware of, that the core scale of our models and the lack of finer scale data are contributing to a mismatch between what's happening and what management is able to do. So what is the next step, or who's going to take that step? Who's in a position to remedy that situation and get science and management synced up to deal with our changing environment? I mean, it would seem like this should be a national priority with appropriations behind it. Because it feels like we're losing ground as we go on. And so it's just an open question. I don't know who would answer it, but are we going to just keep getting reports like this indicating every year that we're not collecting the right information to answer the right questions? Or is there going to be some action taken?
Mr. Nice?
I mean, so I don't know if Dr. Sabo wants to talk about the administration's proposed budget for fiscal year 2023, which I think includes considerable funding for some of these climate initiatives. But that, of course, is just a proposed budget. It hasn't even been discussed yet, I don't think. So the administration, at least I believe, has put in some efforts to increase funding for these. I don't know if, Vince, you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, so unfortunately for our current budget, FY22, the climate, it was called the Climate Fisheries Initiative, which is a NOAA-wide program, tens of millions, I believe, between multiple NOAA-line offices, mostly dedicated toward NOAA climate fisheries. Unfortunately, it wasn't funded for multiple reasons, the war, other reasons as well, but it was put, as Tom just mentioned, as a priority for FY23. So if that does, in fact, get funded, it will allow us to, it's not just a modeling proposal, it is a program. It is also, you know, one of the key objectives of this, what's now called the CEFI, the Climate Ecosystem Fisheries Initiative, is also improve stakeholder engagement. So getting this new climate management ready information, into to our stakeholders, is a key objective of the CEFI. So we have our fingers crossed that this will, in fact, be funded. The other programs that we've historically relied on have been our New England Groundfish Climate Program, which has been about $2.5 million per year, which is allocated by Congress. Unfortunately, we had some issues with funding this year, so that's another pot that we heavily rely on for conducting some of this research that could potentially be management relevant. But we're hoping the CEFI gets funded for next fiscal year. So thanks, Tom, for bringing that up.
Does either Dr. Kerr or Dr. Simpkins wish to add to that?
I can add a little bit. I mean, I will say, you know, there is ongoing work in this area, I think happening particularly through the research track stock assessment processes right now. There's a particular term of reference that asks for these groups to examine how climate and ecosystem change is impacting stock dynamics and consider that and how they address other terms of reference, like the actual fitting of the assessment model. And so I think you will start to see this information coming out of ongoing research tracks. I think there's been a lot of dedication, and despite the kind of funding issues that Vince noted, I think there's been a dedication of staff time. So I can speak to the research track processes I'm involved with, having staff time from both the ecosystem branch dedicated to participating in those research tracks is helping us integrate climate impacts and test some of these ideas in that in those constructs. So I think, you know, Vince noted there's a need for more funding in this area. There's a lot more work to do, but there is ongoing work that I think will be starting to filter out into be reviewed.
Dr. Simpkins?
I think Lisa and Vince covered most of the Juan Tom covered most of what I would say. I mean, I think we're also going to hear about the states-based modeling efforts that the center's engaged in, that the NRCC is engaged in later in this meeting, which is another opportunity. It's the WAM model that Vince mentioned. It's another opportunity to fold some of this information in. So there is, to your question, John, there is a lot of work underway. The fundamental big picture question I think you had about, like, how do we get the sampling ramped up? That's a big influx of cash, and I think that's where this CEFI could help. We had hopes that we'd get some of these funds this year and didn't, so our fingers remain crossed, I guess.
Mr. Papalardo?
Yeah, it's helpful to hear that, Mr. Chairman. I was aware of some of those things, not so clear on others, but it does sound like there's attention, focus, and activity in the planning. I just hope it's being integrated and will end up benefiting the stakeholders and the managers. Thank you.
Dr. Sisselwine.
I really appreciate this discussion. I'm all in favor of more money for all of these activities. But I still feel like we're not following up with the actual design of the processes that address particularly what are the Magnuson Act requirements mean to rebuild fisheries in the context of the rebuilding target being a moving target. I mean, that's very explicitly what the implications are of climate change, particularly directional climate change with a trend. The BMSY is a moving target, and it's not just randomly fluctuating. It's moving with trend. Now, I mean, I can think of all sorts of ways that one might adopt management to be more consistent with that. Some of them may be good, some of them may be lousy. But is that going to be addressed within this action plan? Are people going to sit down and actually try to come to grips with those sort of issues, would be my question.
It's my understanding it's a science plan, not a management plan, Mike, but if anybody else wants to correct me.
I mean, the goal is to get the science done that management needs to do just that. And that's exactly why we're trying to get feedback on, you know, what us folks as scientists can do, where we can focus and target our funds and our RFPs when they do come out each year, to these different questions. I know it's not simple, you know, but that's exactly right.
Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I'm fine with it being a science plan. I'm totally supportive of all the science. But, you know, let's say all the science gets done and we have a new stock assessment for winter flounder, whatever the species is, 2 years from now or a year from now, and it says that the biological reference points are dynamic. Are we then going to start to discuss what that means and how to deal with them, or is a process underway to address the likely outcome of this scientific process? And so that's the concern I'm raising about how all this plays out is when you're doing science and you anticipate that the science is going to be successful and produce new products in terms of information, it just seems to me to be appropriate to be planning in advance and having a dialogue with the stakeholders in advance of how that new information will actually get used. And it's not clear right now that's actually happening. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Doctor. All good points. So I'm going to move to Mr. Nice. He's the HeBets cleanup on this program. So Mr. Nice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Dr. Saba and Dr. Kerr, for your reports. So the thing before the council now is, do we want to comment on this regional action plan? We have the comments that the SSC offered that we might want to forward on to the agency. There's also a document, I think it's document number 9B, it's under tab 1, which are some comments that the staff put together based on our review of the action plan. I'm not going to go through these in considerable detail. I'm not going to go through them in any detail, to be honest with you. I would just point out that hopefully you've had a chance to look at them. And there is a theme here that I think we've heard both from Dr. Saba, Dr. Kerr, and from several council members already that is represented in one of the first bullets here, which is, but is also carried over in a number of other comments in the staff comments, which is doing the science is great. How do we get the science into the management process and how does it get used? And the regional action plan seems to fall short.